Hello and welcome to the second episode of The Hopeless Romantic. This episode is called 50,000 Bottles of Beer on the Wall, and 50,000 because we are going to be talking about NaNoWriMo.
I'm Austin Chant.
I'm Amanda Jean. So this episode is going to be talking a little bit about the writing process of NaNo, which Austin will be covering the majority of because I have never won NaNo and he has won it.
Nine times
as of this year. And I'll be talking about the structural requirements of NaNo. If you're writing a romance novel in 50,000 words, what that looks like, what kind of beats you need to hit.
I'm going to be talking about, well, not sore limbs exactly, but my process for NaNoWriMo changed pretty drastically this year because I have acute tendonitis in both of my wrists.
Mm-hmm. Not just one. You had to have both because you're special.
And I can neither type nor write by hand or really do anything with my hands. So I actually, for the first time, used dictation software to write. It was something I'd never done before for any reason. I had to make kind of a paradigm shift to dictation software for this NaNoWriMo. So I'm going to be talking a little bit about that.
And I should say for the record, because this has been dogging me for weeks, that the original title of this episode was, wait for it, NaNoHomo. But we figured, since no homo, while it is, you know, a big part of pop culture, is sort of a slur. So we didn't want to give you guys the impression that NaNoHomo is the way we're going to go. However, you should still know that it was a hilarious pun, and I'm sad to see the end of it.
Yeah.
So, Austin, I would love it if you would tell me a little bit about your history with NaNo.
Yeah. So I started, the first year I did NaNoWriMo was 2005, and I was a wee 12-year-old, and I wrote 5,000 words. I started on November 15th, because that was the first time I heard of NaNoWriMo was on November 15th as it was already going. And I was like, wow, this sounds cool.
Cute.
But of course, when you're 12 years old and you're starting, you know, 15 days late.
How much did you manage to write?
I wrote 5,000 words and stopped.
Oh, that's adorable.
And they were bad words. And then after that, I won NaNo for the first time. And I have won every year after that. Not to boast, but
you should boast. That's an impressive feat.
And I really, really, really love NaNo. It is like, it's something that I put aside time for every year, even if I don't have time to do it, because for me, like, it really helped me grow as a writer. It's one of those things that is just completely fundamental to my writing process, is having an event that really got me into the writing space of not editing as I went, of just like putting it out there. What I had in my head, in my mind, NaNo is what you make of it. And so I've done some non-traditional NaNos, like I have edited for NaNo before, which is...
Isn't that like the number one rule of NaNo?
Honestly, don't do it. It's not fun because it's really hard to get into a good editing groove when you're thinking about word count. And it's hard not to think of word count when you're doing NaNoWriMo. And I've also rewritten books from scratch that I'd already written during NaNo. And I've done don't do that either. That's also rough. Really, it's good to start with a fresh idea, if only so you're not sitting there like, oh, but I really loved that one scene from the first version that now is my precious baby angel that I have to keep in there at all costs, but I have to rewrite everything.
Well, rewriting is a difficult proposition, and I mean, while it can be done in a month, you can definitely do rewrites for a 50K novel in a month. I don't think that is really the best format for it.
It's a lot like editing, because if you're rewriting something, generally it's because you've written it once, you see the flaws in it. It's essentially like editing without editing, so it's also very difficult to be doing that kind of like... that cognitive thing where you're looking at something you've written before.
You're also seeing nothing but the flaws in it. I mean, exactly. Unless you are seeing like your little precious gems and going like, why
must I abandon
this? For me, usually
it's a mix of the two. It's like, I hate this generally, but this one scene I must keep at all costs.
Yeah.
And it's easier to not do that if I'm not doing it during NaNoWriMo. And I've also done very planned out NaNos. And I've done some very... what they call in the NaNo community, pantsed novels.
Pantsing.
Flying by the seat of your pants, which is where you do not plan ahead of time and just start with, you know,
your
rough idea. And a
German of an idea.
Yeah.
Some people do somewhere between pantsing and outlining, which is they outline in their head.
Mm-hmm.
They keep it all neatly stored in their head, which I can't do.
I can't do that either.
It's scary in there.
For me, that is when I lose everything. I was just talking today about how even if I just have... dialogue notes. Like, I woke up this morning and I thought about dialogue and I knew if I didn't write it down immediately, I would just spend like the next week being like, what were those smart, witty things that my characters would have said? I don't know. I'll never know.
You write them down where it's a paraphrase. It's an approximation of the original genius idea you had, and nothing ever measures up to that, yeah. Like 1 a.m.
And you know you thought of it and it was so good and you'll never find it again.
You'll never find it again.
But yeah, and this year was a kind of a departure from the way I'd been doing Nano recently. I'd started to tend more towards like really planned out stuff. I had sort of started to use NaNoWriMo as a way to work on projects I was already working on. So for a couple years, I had used it either for projects that I had really, really meticulously planned out ahead of time or to finish, continue, or rewrite projects I'd already done. And I was going to do that this year, but the day before Nano, I latched onto a sudden new idea that I was completely in love with, and despite Amanda's advice, decided to roll with it.
I wouldn't call it advice. I'd call it abuse.
You were like, "Don't do it! Don't do it! You're horrible! Like you're."
I basically
monster.
Called you a garbage fire four or five times just for.
You were like, "Don't do it!" Which, to be fair, I had switched ideas so many times.
In the last,
I feel like you were fatigued by how many times I had been like, actually,
for Nano,
I'm not working on that. Actually, I'm working on something else.
Well, I also know the perils of changing your mind at the last minute and then realizing that you've set aside this project that you've been outlining in your head or even physically outlining for something that is a pants idea, which shouldn't it doesn't work for everybody, but like, spoiler alert, Austin.
Well, and I think, so there's a double-edged sword there. There's a, you know, in some ways, a pantsed idea can be bad in that an idea always sounds good when you first have it and you haven't thought about it very hard. And then when you get into the nitty gritty of it is when it gets difficult and when you run into plot holes and you run into like character flaws that you didn't think about and your plot actually doesn't work as well as you thought. But I also think that kind of burning inspiration for something that is completely untempered by logic or deep thoughts about
it
can be really powerful motivational tool because it totally happened where I was with this story and in about the second or third week, I was like, oh, I haven't thought about this very hard. This part doesn't work. I have to rewrite the ending, et cetera, et cetera. But for the first like 2 weeks, I was completely just like, I love this story. I'm so happy to be writing it. And I don't think I would have felt that way. The original idea I went with turned out to be something that would have been hard for me to write right now because it was very emotionally intense and super, super social justice-y in a way that could have been like slightly painful and difficult. And I chose to go with something that was like really happy. And that I think was really good for Nano because it is a time to work on your craft, but it's also kind of a different space than you normally create.
You don't want to punish yourself with...
Yeah.
Because you're already setting yourself up for a very stressful crunch time trying to make word count every single day. Which, by the way, is it for 50K, is it 1667 words per day that you need to be writing?
And that's to make... That's like if you are scraping... Like,
the bare minimum, and you don't have any backlog.
That's you are going to get to the 50,000th word on the last day at midnight. Yeah. I usually try to aim for like 2,000 words
just so
there's padding, because there's inevitably going to be a day, or spoilers, in this case, an entire week where I'm not going to be able to
sit down
work
and write
on my novel.
Yeah.
But yeah, just to wrap up that thought, this Nano, I decided to use it as a more wild creative space. Which is what it is. You know, it was for me very flying by the seat of my pants, very just, I'm gonna let myself go into the writing zone and see what happens. And it wound up being very cathartic and freeing and fun in a way that it hasn't been the last couple years that I've done it. And so
that's a win-win.
I recommend
situation,
that approach
too.
I mean, I think you can do kind of whatever works for you during Nano, but it was really fun to do that.
Yeah, I did notice you were, I think, a lot less burdened by your project with this one, especially because you had you had so many stressors. You had the fact that you couldn't type. You had the fact that your original project would have been deeply emotional and personal for you. And then on top of that, you were trying to make 50,000 words while also still living life.
mm-hmm.
which is not simple. And I was actually going to say, I have never won Nano. I've probably said that before, and I'll say it again because it is a shame I live with in my daily life.
No shame!
Especially because a lot of people I know do Nano successfully and have done it to, you know, 2 and 3 times the word goal, which is staggering, but also, you know, not everyone can do that. And I'm certainly not a writer who writes quickly or particularly does well with deadlines like that.
Mm-hmm.
If you're an author who is new to Nano, let's say you're going to do it this next year because it's December, not November. We decided to do this.
We really wanted to do a Nano episode, but then it scheduling wise wound up being the end of November. So we're doing more of a wrap up slash for next time kind of deal.
Well, it's also one of those things where when you're in the middle of Nano, it's harder to see the forest for the trees.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think anyone in the middle of Nano necessarily wants to be told about Nano.
Yeah, they know. They know too much.
I'm in the trenches. I'm in here too deep.
Yep.
But I wanted to talk about what it looks like to write a 50,000-word queer romance novel, because guess what? 50,000 words is a very important figure for most romance novels.
Yes.
The majority of presses I know print, send books to print at 50K. Like, that's usually, it's 45 or 50K. Sometimes it's a little higher.
Yeah.
But if you've written a novel or a novella, it has to be 50K to go to print, generally speaking, unless you've sold like gangbusters and they're desperate to get you on shelves.
Yeah, absolutely. It's no coincidence that if you are kind of browsing the market, you'll see a lot of books that land right at 50K. And there's a lot of structure built into 50K, even to how to get to 50K in a month that is kind of endemic to books in general, but also romances. There's a lot of like storytelling structure that's built into that.
Yeah, romance has a bad rap for being bad rep, bad rap. One of the two. It has a... No one trusts romance. It's a bad boy set on a Vespa scooter in a yep. leather jacket. For good or for ill, romance has a reputation of being formulaic. And it is formulaic, but that's because formula works and structure is important. And when there's an entire industry and an entire genre built on the back of very careful structural conventions, you would be better equipped to know what the structure is before you start pantsing your way through it for, mm-hmm. for better.
Yeah, because I think the point isn't really, you know, don't deviate from traditional noveling structures. It's more just that, you know, those conventions, they're conventions for a reason. Like, they're really well known. They're kind of invisible to the reader. They're mm-hmm. one of those things that you can use without it being obvious. So it really behooves you to know what those structures are, so that when you deviate from them, you're doing so intentionally and you're kind of compensating.
You're accounting for the changes that you made.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, from a marketing standpoint, readers have certain expectations of romance novels. And when someone disregards some of them, the readers may even not know what they're... I mean, the readers are super intelligent, and the reviews I see are so thoughtful in deconstructing structural issues and where things buck convention. But, you know, some readers may not necessarily be aware of that or how to articulate it, but they still know that something isn't following the party line.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's important for you to understand what the structural expectation is, so that when you change it, and I'll talk a little bit more with examples, when you change it, it's not like a sore thumb that's sticking out. It's mm-hmm. it's a feature and not a bug.
Yeah, it can be really good. One of the things I try to do, even if I'm pantsing a novel, is to have roughly the beats of the story somewhere in my brain, even if I change it later,
mm-hmm.
to be able to be like, not necessarily beginning, middle, end, but kind of arcs of the story planned out, so that I have the flow of the story in mind. And even if I'm not fixing it or rewriting it in the moment, I kind of know where I've deviated from the structure, or where, say, my, you know, my first act is going on way longer than a traditional first act would go.
Yeah.
So that later I can either choose to do that, I hope, intentionally and successfully, rather than accidentally and poorly.
Yeah, you don't want it to be, you know, you don't want it to be a happy accident that you managed to successfully cobble together a novel.
Yeah.
You want it to be fairly deliberate.
There
I
needs
mean,
to be some structural planning.
Yeah,
know?
There has to be a
little
bit.
Build yourself a nice foundation.
I still think about the poor editor who has to deal with the, like, okay, so wait a minute, do you even have, like, act two? Like,
yeah, where's your subplot? Like,
Where's your... I did actually want to say for newbie authors or newbie nanoers, what a 50,000-word queer romance novel would look like. And they're generally three-act structures. In MM, which is, as we know, sort of the industry giant, the conventions are typically dual POV, usually third-person limited. So you have fairly closed-off point of view that they either change it every chapter or they have scene breaks. Mm-hmm. And that's when the POV shifts. You do see some first-person, but first-person is very difficult to do well. You have to be fairly skillful at it to really hook an audience. Some people love first person. I, as an editor, am kind of on the fence about it. When it's done well, it is, you don't notice that you're reading first person.
Mm-hmm.
When it's done poorly, it feels like you're reading someone's diary and not a fun diary.
Like the unedited diary I wrote when I was 12.
Yeah, exactly. With like a lot of exclamation points. And then it's generally in past or present tense. Clearly, there's not a whole bunch of tense options to change.
As opposed to the future tense. The future tense.
Yeah. Like, can you imagine?
In the future.
Second person future. Yeah. He would.
You will see your soulmate walk through the door, but not yet. He will have raven hair, flowing locks.
Oh no,
cold, dark eyes.
Cultish limbs. He's a horse again.
He's a horse.
And I should mention that the dual POV three-act structure, you know, generally third person limited, is really similar to a lot of het romance novels mm-hmm. too. We take a lot of it from there.
Yeah, and all of this again is it's very much you know, this is what readers are used to. Like, this is what people see the most. That doesn't mean that other variations are in any way bad, because, like, obviously, if we wanted to go to what everybody knows, we would write everything in third person, but there are really, really, really good, really powerful first person books out there. Something that I feel really strongly about is I love present tense, like, so much that I actually really struggle to write stuff in past tense. I wrote my nano novel in past tense, and it took me, like, 5 or 10,000 words before I stopped switching back to present tense, because it's so my default. It's also not super common for books to be written in present. And I've also wrote another nano novel in first person present tense once, which is even more uncommon. Although The Hunger Games is in first person present, and The Hunger Games is awesome. And that POV totally lends itself to the story that Suzanne Collins was telling. So it's a great
tense. There's our plug for The Hunger Games.
Yeah. Shout out to The Hunger Games. You're welcome, Suzanne Collins.
Suzanne Collins needed our help.
Yeah. She's going to make it big one day. I really, really love those, but I think it's also good to know when you're doing something unconventional.
It should be a deliberate choice, is essentially what we're saying.
I really like single POV. I write characters best when I can really, really get in the zone for that one character. So I tend to break from the conventions in a lot of ways, but I try to do it to serve the story that I'm telling, and to make sure that what I'm doing is not distracting from the story, because a lot of good writing is invisible. Like, a lot of good writing doesn't jump out at the reader and say, like, here I am.
Look at my technical prowess.
Yes, here I am. I'm in first person and I'm beautiful. It's when you're reading a book and it's just natural that you're hearing the voice of this character speaking to you directly as themselves, as opposed to in third person. I was recently reading some Oscar Wilde, which it's not really romance. The Picture of Dorian Gray, not really a romance novel, but I'm going to bring it up anyway.
Unless you're
because
into
it's
that.
Well, Lord Henry.
Lord comma Henry.
Lord comma Henry. I love that book. But it's written in, I don't know that the conventions were all that well-defined in Oscar Wilde's day, but it's written in third omniscient.
Which is also extremely difficult to do.
Which is extremely difficult.
And if you're just starting out, don't do it.
Yeah, I mean, feel free to practice. But it is a really...
Well, this is the thing. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah, go for
it. This is the thing. I feel like authors who write what they want to write, to learn their style, to learn how to do things, to learn what works for them and what doesn't work for them, should write whatever they want, whenever the fuck they want to do it. The problem is when you're looking at selling a book to a very competitive and specific market, the time to experiment isn't with that book. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe wait until you've got some things under your belt, and maybe wait until you feel comfortable with the established parameters before you start changing them.
Because you're just layering on difficulties, yeah. I think.
And I mean, especially when you're looking at submitting something to a press, and they open it and they see that it's third omni, mm-hmm. or they see that it's first person present, or they see that it's got a lot of POVs, they're going to really
wonder what's going on. Yeah. And it's, you know, it might be harder for them to market.
It
might be harder to find a readership for that.
And it's harder to edit, honestly. Yeah.
Especially because it's one of those things where it takes trust for a reader to pick up a book and dive in. Like, and it takes trust that if you don't have anything to establish that trust,
opening up a book and seeing that it's first person or third omni, mm-hmm. is difficult.
It's difficult because that means, you know, there's just layers and layers of difficulty to get somebody to trust you enough to read your book. And you can really increase that. I remember one edit that was made to my first novella, Coffee Boy, was to change the first sentence so it did not have, what was it? It was like, you would really think that blank. It was recommended for me to change that. So that it was not in, what is it that even?
That's second.
Second.
Yeah. Well, it's like, it's addressing the audience, honestly.
And it wasn't in second person. It was in third person with a very chatty, third person narrator. But
I'm strongly against using, if you're writing third person limited or third person any, using you when you're basically breaking the fourth wall and addressing the audience, mm-hmm. is not my favorite thing to do. You can do it in thoughts. Mm-hmm. You can do it in thoughts, but yeah. don't and recommend
it's, again, it
in again,
it's like,
narrative.
It's something you can do well, but especially because it was the first line of mm-hmm. the book. And I remember two different people being like, maybe don't do that, because if somebody who's never picked up your book before, has never read you before, and obviously they haven't because you've never published anything before, they might see that and be like, second person? No.
Yeah, a lot of people have very strong opinions on second
and like
person.
That might, and you know, that might seem unfair, but like, it's people's time and money. You know, if they want a book that they want to read, you can't really blame them. And so the conventions are there for a reason. They're powerful.
And they are, I mean, they are a bit rigid in some respects. But the thing that I'm trying to sort of hammer home is that you can do things that are outside of the box. You can break the conventions. You just have to be very deliberate and careful in how you do it, mm-hmm. because you don't want it to be an accident. You don't want it to be because you didn't know that stories are usually, they're not all dual POV, but frequently romance is dual POV.
I mean, and I totally get that because I write almost exclusively single POV. And then I read romance novels and I'm like, ugh, it's so much easier for them to describe both protagonists.
The funny thing is when because you don't have to resort to any trickery where you're like...
So the book that I wrote for Nano, I was in an endless struggle to... Because I had a protagonist who is not very vain, doesn't think about his appearance very much, trying to figure out how to physically describe him to anywhere near the degree that I had described his
love interest,
who was very exhaustively described, like his voice, his face, his everything, his height, his clothes.
Was your main character like a stalker?
No, but like, he's in love, Amanda. He's thinking a lot about the other guy. So over the course of the book, like, the love interest had built up like a pretty exhaustive, like, physical description. But the main character, I could tell, was kind of like...
vague.
Yeah.
Amorphous.
He was just kind of an amorphous blob. Amorphous.
Is it amorphous or amorphous?
It's amorphous, I think.
Don't put that in the
I think we should put that in the podcast.
Oh.
But anyway, he was kind of an amorphous blob of questionable height and facial appearance and other things.
And you can't, I mean, I also advise people, unless you've got a really good reason for it, please don't write the scene where they're standing in front of a mirror.
Look in the mirror. I almost did it.
I've done it.
I was so desperate.
I try to be clever about it. I'm like, he's just looking at his eye bags, and then I'll like stick in, which is such a sexy description. Ooh, my eye bags. Looking good today.
But yeah, no, I was sitting there. I was just like, he has to look in a mirror. Otherwise, how will they know that he has big, dark eyes? But like...
like a deer.
Who, aside from me, looks in the mirror and goes, look at my big, dark eyes that I have and have always had every other day, except for this, when I felt the need to stand in front of my mirror and describe my face to myself.
I've never seen my face before. It's a surprise every time. Mm-hmm. You really don't want to give the audience the impression that your character is... needlessly vain, which can happen.
Well, and it's tricky because, like, you want to establish relatively early on, like, who your character is. Like, you want the establishing moment, which is why I think dual POVs are such a convention when you have dual protagonists, mm-hmm. because you want to show both of them from different angles, and it can be very effective to say, like, this is character A from their point of view, and you get their personality, and then they see and describe the other character. You switch POVs, that character gets their personality and their voice on the page, and they describe the other character. It's really effective. And that's, again, why that's a convention.
You also get to disclose information that the other characters do not have, mm-hmm. which can create some really interesting conflict on the or tension for the reader, which is, you know, super important.
Yeah. And, it's really important to be able to describe characters, I think, from their own point of view and another person's point of view, because you can get so much out of a person from the differences in how they perceive themselves and their actions and the way other people
and
perceive themselves.
How self-aware are people, really? Mm-hmm. I mean, generally speaking.
That's something that romance novel conflicts do that's always really fun, is like you have a character who's totally justified to themselves and is like, I'm so nice and smart and da-da-da.
Completely correct.
And then you get them from the other person's point of view and you're like, wow, they're an asshole. Or they're kind of a snob. Or like they have no idea how they come off. And so that can be a really easy, cool, like invisible way to establish conflict.
I already discussed how romance novels are generally what POV they're in, how long they are, at least to reach print. You can definitely go longer, but a lot of authors tend to stay in the 50 to 60 to 70 range because it's cheaper for the mm-hmm. reader too. When you start yanking up the word count, the price point goes up too. So what else you need to look at is the fact that you've got your main character and your secondary main character. Sometimes, depending on how you've structured it, they're just kind of the love interest, mm-hmm. which is something I want to caution people about doing. Like, please don't have one main character who is your child and you develop them to the point of excess and you're like, yes, they are the linchpin of the story. And then you introduce a love interest who is just scaffolding. Like, make sure that your two main characters, your heroes or your heroines, are fully fledged characters who would be interesting in a story of their own where they'd never even met. The things you need to know are their personal goal. What is their driving motivation in life? And this is where a lot of interesting conflict can come out, because if you've got someone with a personal goal, a vendetta, a dream, something they're aspiring to, the love interest or even the antagonist can come in and be like, no, not that. You can't have that. And there you go. Instant conflict.
Yeah. And it's so interesting when you have two characters who are or eventually will be in love with each other or affectionate for each other in some way, who have totally opposed goals, mm-hmm. who have like opposite goals, because that creates a conflict that you can't just skirt around.
Yeah, no, that has you to actually to, come to some sort
you
of
You have
head.
To see, like, how do they come to a compromise? And it can be really compelling when you're reading along and you've got, like, you know, these two characters are at odds, but I want them to be together. How are they going to do it? How are they going to make it?
I was also going to say, in terms of structure, most likely the two main characters, the main character and the love interest or the secondary main character, should meet in Act One. It's not 100% necessary, but the thing is, if they don't meet in Act One and you're working in 50,000 words of real estate, you have spent... Because Act One is roughly going to be if you're doing it exactly by like the word count, if you're chopping it up, it's going to be 13,000 words in roughly. Mm-hmm. If you've spent 13,000 words with the main character and you haven't introduced their love interest, that means you have 13,000 words less to describe, to get to know, to make intriguing the mm-hmm. love interest. So
yeah, so it's again something that like you can do.
You can definitely do it.
You want to do it intentionally, and you want to again compensate then for
you. They better have something super dynamic that they're
yeah, because you want those sparks to fly, and you got to understand that what you're doing is a deviation from how the genre tends to do those things. Not to say like I have read romance novels where that is done so well, mm-hmm. like where the love interest does not come in until way later in the story, and it's still every bit as compelling. It usually requires that core protagonist who is like leading the story for most of the way is really compelling without, you know, somebody to bounce off of.
But you also, that's what I was saying earlier, is you need that second, you need that love interest to be equally or comparably interesting and dynamic. And it has to be as fully formed in your own mind to be interesting to the audience.
Yeah.
And you don't want to rely on the idea of the audience being so into the idea, like, oh, we love this main character. We want them, we want to see them get their happy ending, that you skimp on the love interest because they'll settle. They'll just be like, oh, it's nice that they got someone at the end of the day. It's nice that they had their happy ending, or they're, you know, they're happily for now. That's kind of not the point.
You want to be happy for both of them.
You want to be happy for both of them. You want both of those characters to get their happy endings, not just your...
You need a protagonist who can carry the story up until the point where they meet, and then you need a second person who is so compelling.
Doing their own thing.
When they barge in, you're like, oh my gosh, I care just as much about this person who I've known for like two pages as I do about this.
Or you immediately hate them.
Or you hate them, yeah.
You need to see them brought low and then redeemed.
The arch nemesis.
I was going to go back to the structure a little bit more. I mentioned that the meeting should likely come in Act 1. If you don't, just know that you're going to have to really be paying attention to how compelling your love interest is. And then also important at the end of Act 1, when you have characters with personal goals, or you have driving elements in the plot like a war, a quest,
awkward family dinner.
Exactly. You need to have a lot of plot guides call it like the point of no return. And essentially, if you're using a quest metaphor, this is the moment where they're on the quest and they can't turn back. Like, this is a point where something has changed. And
the fellowship has left.
I literally have that in my notes. It's like Frodo is on the fucking road to Mordor and he's not turning around for anything.
Not even for Sam.
Don't bring your shipping. but you want your Act 1 to really have a sense of momentum. Things are going places. People are doing things. The status quo has been shaken up. And again, it doesn't necessarily have to come at the end of Act 1. It can come a little earlier. It could be in medias res, where you're starting in the middle of action. Is it res or res? Who fucking knows? You're starting in the middle of action and like things are happening. There's been a catalyst moment and people are in motion and everything's, you know, chaotic. But generally speaking, end of Act 1. So I was going to talk a little bit about conflict, and this is not actually an episode on necessarily what these things are. I will include some links in the episode description to a couple of really handy tools. One of them is this, it's by Jamie Gold, and it's a romance novel beat sheet, which is a spreadsheet where you can plug in what your word count goal is, and it will tell you, generally speaking, what your beat should be. Like, how long should Act 1 be? And she says like 2,500 words. Yes, Act 1 is 2,500 words. That's all you get. You better introduce those characters quickly.
Yep.
12,500. And I've also got, I'll have a link to Harlequin's three-act structure, which is more basic, but it does give you, you know, everything you need to know about conflict and when you introduce it. There's also Kay Dacus's 7 story beats, which is helpful. So those will be at the bottom of the episode description if you want to check them out. I have used them. I know people who use them. The beat sheet is especially useful because you can literally plug it in and see the numbers, and you can account for it accordingly.
Yeah, it's really cool to see where you kind of match up with those and where you
can do it with an existing manuscript. You can plug it in and see like, oh, this particular beat should be this word count or this page count, and it doesn't have to be exact. Good God.
Like, I still go back to those structures, and I've written like a lot of books for Nano. I still go back to those structures just to kind of refamiliarize myself with what the foundations of these books are built on, because like at this point that's what it is. It's not like this arbitrary thing. It's
not
a
stream of consciousness. It also helps you plot.
Yeah,
because if you know what you need, you can sit around and think, well, oh crap, I need a dark moment at the end of Act 2.
Yeah,
what can I do to my characters that fits into my plot at the end of Act 2 that will give me that what I need? Because you need that crisis of faith. It's important,
and it's good. You know, it can help you also diagnose problems with your manuscript that maybe you're like, why does this not feel compelling here? You might discover like, oh, there's no conflict from here to here.
Yeah, you need
a
bridge.
Or like this subplot has been going on for too long and now it's kind of stale. Or the reason that this feels rushed is because I could have introduced it 20 pages earlier or whatever, you know?
Or when I was plotting this, I hung my hat on this being the pivotal conflict, and it turns out it's not really that dynamic, so I need to fix it.
Yeah, exactly.
I was going to say, too, be careful in romance to not use... when you're in Act 2, Act 2 can kind of drag because you've set up the characters. There's not the, like, the meeting. You don't need to worry about that. You've got the ball in motion, and you can kind of get bogged down by getting from point A to point B and then to the ending. And one of the things that you do to keep it from dragging is to raise the stakes. Another thing authors in romance do is start to put in a lot of sex. Mm-hmm. Which I am for. I like a romance novel with some smut in it. I'm for that. Not for every novel and not for every author, but I am excited usually. Shut up. Don't use sex scenes as filler, and don't use them primarily as emotional shorthand. Mm-hmm. There is a lot you can do in sex scenes to progress characterization, to progress relationship dynamic, to even progress plot if you're really just thinking of it that way. But if you bog it down with too much, you're using it as a crutch instead of a useful tool.
One of my number one pet peeves is sex scenes that are pointless. Mm-hmm. Like, and that is not to
and
say
not just that, because like they're hot, they're fine, they yeah, work, they're
like,
in character.
That's not to say that like it's bad to have like sex for the sake of sex and things, and you know, obviously
if you're
like,
writing erotica, that's sort of partially yeah. the name of the game.
And yet, like when I say for no point, what I mean is not that it's just sex. What I mean is like a sex scene should be like any other scene in your book. It should be doing something.
It has, like, there is a purpose for this scene here, and it's not just because you were like, oh, my character should.
Yeah, it's not just like a reward for the reader for getting to a certain point in your book.
like, I know this story is 80,000 words long. I'm real sorry. I'm going to throw you this bone.
Here's a sex scene. You know, I know you've been here a long time. You keep reading. Thanks.
I will say I have seen readers complaining that, you know, they read like an 80K story and there wasn't enough sex in it, or like, oh, I really would have.
I'm that reader. Yeah. I'll be
I've
real.
Been that reader, but at the same time, you know.
But I would rather have a book, you know, that is well crafted, that says, I don't need this. I'm not going to put this in here.
Because it has to serve the character's arcs. It mm-hmm. can't just be like, we're both real hot and we have a lot of feelings that aren't going anywhere. And we're going to bone now because the author is like, shit, I need to get this.
Something's got to happen here. And I
Frodo and Sam don't need to make a pit stop in Rivendell.
Anyway, I was going to say, I think that sex scenes should be taken as more of an opportunity to develop characters and show parts of their relationship and themselves that you don't see in other contexts, because there's so much tied up in cultural expectations of sex, in the way people view themselves, in the way people view their bodies, in the way they view their partners. Like, there's so much there that you can access that is not as readily on the
yeah.
surface,
it's not
in
surface.
In other contexts. And it bothers me not to see sex scenes that are just about sex, because to be fair, a sex scene can be about sex. That's totally fair.
They don't need to be having an entire discussion
about
it.
When it's not about the characters
exactly.
in the scene having sex is
when, you
when
could,
it bothers
when
me.
When you could find replace.
Exactly. It should be about those characters in that scene at that moment in that context and what that means to them. It shouldn't just be about, I need to write a sex scene, in which case, you know, you might as well just have two completely different or three or more. Not to be binary, any number of other characters who are not your protagonists having sex, because, you know, it's not about them. It's just about the need to write a sex scene. What gets awkward is when it's sort of isolated from the rest of the story and it doesn't follow and it doesn't feel like it's a part of it.
It feels like literally porn music on a Casio just started somewhere and there's an interlude and then it's yeah. over and then you're on to the next point.
Mm-hmm.
In the
and
story.
I think it can be that way because there is such a cultural stigma around sexuality, and I think you can especially get that then with queer sex. When you're dealing with all this baggage and expectation, and this is like a big thing, and it's maybe the characters have like internalized stuff that they're working through at the same time, it can feel like it's separate and different, but it's not.
Well,
you know,
it's
another scene.
There's some presses that definitely put an emphasis on quantity in terms of sex scenes. They want it to reach a certain heat level. Mm-hmm. They want it to have a certain number of scenes in it or a certain number of acts in it. And there's nothing wrong with that because there's an audience for that, and sometimes that's what your story calls for. But be careful in following that, because you will end up writing something where it could literally just be any two people or any mm-hmm. three people engaging yeah. in sex acts with absolutely no resonance for the reader.
Why you gotta limit it to three people?
Apparently three's my cutoff. I don't know. Seven people.
Okay.
70.
Okay. you know, there's nothing wrong with pursuing a certain heat level for your book, or with presses wanting to be able to say, like, this is erotica versus this is not erotica.
Well, it's also like when they're marketing erotica, they can't be like, oh, it's erotica because it has sex in it. It has to have a certain amount of sex and a certain kind of sex.
Certain settings. And where it kind of can get dangerous as an author is if you're not thinking about writing a story that meshes with that goal, or writing characters who mesh with that goal for number and quantity and type of sex scenes.
So before we sign off here, I wanted to ask you a little bit about how you have managed to wrangle 50,000 words in a month while using dictation software.
All right. Well, yeah. So I got tendonitis about a month's notice before Nano, and then I didn't realize that I wasn't going to be able to use my hands to work for Nano until about a week before. The beginning of Nano, I was really learning how to use dictation software. And the thing that I kind of saw coming, but took some time to deal with, was that it slowed me down dramatically. I think the first day that I really sat down and worked on my novel, I wrote about 3,000 words, but it took so long. It took and it was agonizing. And the dictation software that I used, Dragon, is really good software, but it gets better the more you use it. And so,
which is a painstaking process.
Exactly. And luckily, it turns out doing NaNoWriMo is a great way to train dictation software. Because, you know, if you're just using it to, like, write your email, you're going to be putting a lot fewer words through it. But if you're writing, like, tens of thousands of words in it, it gets smarter really fast. And you're giving it a lot of material to work with to analyze your voice and the way you construct sentences.
Didn't it do a creepy thing to you where you wrote cum and it...
That was Google.
Google is creepier than Dragon.
Yeah. Yes, this is a very interesting. I'm so glad I'm on a podcast where I can talk about that.
You mean you haven't told everyone you know?
I was writing notes for a sex scene, and I wrote, and you know, I did not write this because I don't spell cum, C-U-M.
Nor do
I. As a rule. So I was writing just notes for a scene that had sex words in it. And
sex words.
And then Naughty. I dictated the word cum, and it automatically spelled it C-U-M. And I just kind of stared at my phone for like a straight minute going, what?
Google is literally sitting there like, hey.
What has science done? It was so weird.
We've reached the point of no return, basically.
I've had with my computer's dictation software, which is Dragon, naturally speaking, I've had more problems with it being very puritanical and innocent. I had an earlier version of the software which didn't know any swear words, and I had to enter them all manually, just one by one, and I kept thinking of new ones. Like, I didn't realize how much I swore in my book until I had to painstakingly sit there like, computer, learn fuckboy. I don't know, just go down the list, but I cannot get it to learn the word cock. It won't do it. It spells it
not even Like a rooster?
No, it's driving me nuts. It spells it C-A-U-L-K every single time.
Oh,
it will
no.
not do anything else.
Is it something about the way you're pronouncing it? Like, maybe if you just were like really hard.
Are you victim
with it.
Blaming me right now?
Yes.
I mean, how else do you think I say it? Cock.
Polk.
I say cock. No, I was tweeting about this the other day. I'm so glad that I have accepting roommates, because I literally sit there like, cock. No, cock. Don't delete that. Delete that. Cock.
I'm really surprised that
spell
that didn't turn on Dragon.
C-O-C-K. All right.
We're moving on.
Like, yeah, so I...
How can it get, like, every other word and not cock? Cock is such a fundamental for writing...
I don't know.
...porn.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean,
certain types of porn.
Yeah, not necessarily. But yeah, I mean, so as a somebody whose novel definitely included erotic content, could I say that more like a robot? Probably.
The robot
it included erotic content. The biggest challenge, and included a lot of trans content. And so I had to teach it words like genderqueer and non-binary and a number of others. I was pleased.
You're teaching a robot to
I'm
learn.
Teaching a robot about trans justice. I had to teach it. I'm still trying to get it to recognize misgendering.
Does it spell like M-I-S-S?
It just keeps going miss blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, no, Dragon.
This is like,
it's really good software, but it was definitely a big adjustment. And it was a really hard process for me to get used to, because the way that I was so used to writing was I'm somebody who can't write a book before I write it. Basically, like the process of typing it out is how I work through thinking about it. And the process of writing a character is how I learn about that character. And when I first started dictating, you know, I was really used to whatever I said out loud was kind of forethought. Like I'd already written about it and thought about it. So it was hard to get into a headspace where I was using my voice the same way that I use my hands, just as a tool to put something on the page.
Well, you're engaging a different part of your brain.
Yeah, it's like, a completely it's a different motor skill. Different.
It's not a motor skill.
Yeah.
Is it a motor skill?
I don't know.
If you're using your mouth?
It's a completely different creative process is what it is. And it felt really strange. It also, I'm a big believer in, even though you do not need to sit in a coffee shop and write to be a writer, I really like, you know, giving yourself that at certain points during Nano being like, I'm going to go sit in a coffee shop because I am an author
and typeity type on my laptop
and everyone will know that I'm writing because I have a NaNoWriMo sticker on my computer. Look at me. I'm a writer. You can't do that when you're dictating.
That's a little bit.
Especially when you're dictating cock. C-O-C-K.
I'm just imagining you muttering in a corner.
Why don't you understand me, computer? Why won't you let me write this sex scene in peace? It's already awkward enough that I'm having to dictate a sex scene to my computer. I think that's our show.
I think that is our show. Thank you so much for listening to us. And I, as usual, have my encouragement to writers to write and submit. And I have chosen two again this week. The first one is for Riptide. They have an open call for submissions, or just, I guess, a general call for submissions for Riptide, Titan, their new YA imprint, and Anglerfish, which is an even newer imprint for something that sort of straddles the line between literary fiction and genre. It's darker. Their tagline is sort of like lurking in the depths. So please be aware of that. Go ahead and check out their submission requirements. I will say that their minimum is 15,000 and their max is 115,000. The second one is The Book Smuggler, which is a call for short stories for summer of 2016. It's open through December 31st, first of all, so you'll want to like get on this. They're really super courting LGBTQIA stories. They're open to romance or horror, and their minimum is 1,500 words, and their maximum is 17,500. I will include both of those links in the episode description, so you can check them out at your leisure.
Our next episode, we're going to have our first guest author on the podcast. We're going to be hosting Sam Schooler, and we're really excited. We're going to talk about writing trans characters and
trans romance, essentially.
Writing trans romance and being trans authors. I'm really excited for that. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Hopeless Romantic. If you enjoyed the podcast, please rate and review on iTunes and share on social media. THR is produced by Daria DeFore, with graphics by Keezy Young and music composed by Carly Ann Warden. Follow us on Twitter at TheHRPodcast and find us on Facebook as The Hopeless Romantic Podcast. If you'd like to send us any feedback, have questions, or are interested in guesting, please email us at thehopelessromanticpodcast@gmail.com.